Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hello, everybody. This is Charlie Kirk, Charlie Kirk Show. We had an amazing episode this last week, and because of just overwhelming demand, we decided to do another bonus episode, AMA, Ask Me Anything. We're live here from Los Angeles. We're going to be taking your questions. This is Charlie Kirk, The Charlie Kirk Show. All right, before we get to your questions, admit it. You think that cybercrime is something that happens to other people. You may think that no one wants your data or that hackers can't grab your passwords or credit card details, but you'd be wrong. Stealing data from unsuspecting people on public Wi-Fi is one of the simplest and cheapest ways for hackers to make money. When you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be writing your passwords and credit card numbers on a huge billboard for the rest of the world to see. That's why I decided to take action, to protect myself from cyber criminals. I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. It's super simple. Every time you turn on your device, you press one button and you're totally secure. It has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. I have it on my Mac. I have it on my iPhone. I use it all the time. Using ExpressVPN, I could safely surf on public Wi-Fi. And, you know, I'm on planes all the time. And they actually say that on planes, it's the most unsecure Wi-Fi imaginable. And that's why you need a VPN. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that I have. ExpressVPN is the number one rated VPN service by TechRadar. Comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/charlie. That's expressvpn.com/charlie for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/charlie. All right, back at the action here. I'm sitting here with our executive producer, The Charlie Kirk Show, producer Andrew. I was just riffing about what I considered to be the dumbest statement of the week, which really says something because we've had some real beauties in the last week.
Man, it's been a horse race this week.
No kidding. So I was reading this yesterday, and so Stacey Abrams, nice enough individual, she said, "Identity politics is exactly who we are, and that's why we won." I mean, hold on a second. So first of all, you lost the governor's race. I don't know why she continues to think she thinks that she won the governor's race in Georgia. She lost by how many votes? I think she lost by at least 40,000 votes. So, Stacey Abrams, you lost the governor's race.
Oh, and by the way, Donald Trump won in 2016. Just in case Democrats still haven't figured that out.
And so here's what she said, the exact quote. Stacey Abrams, "I would argue that identity politics is exactly who we are, and it's exactly how we won. By centering communities in Georgia." I'm sorry, I can't help but laugh. She lost! "We not only increased voter participation, we brought new folks to the process." Remember, Stacey Abrams ran in that hotly contested Georgia governor's race against Brian Kemp, and Brian Kemp won. And so here's what's so dangerous, though, is that she is now glamorizing divisive identity politics. And in a previous episode, I talked about the American Trinity, which is the three concepts of first and foremost, e pluribus unum, the Latin phrase that means out of many one. The second part of the American Trinity is the word liberty, which means you can do what you want to do, how you want to do it, but you have to take responsibility for yourself. The third thing is the phrase, "In God we trust." Then I also juxtapose it with the leftist trinity. Now, I want to give Dennis Prager credit for the American Trinity. He's been talking about it for years. The leftist trinity is of my creation, but I give Dennis Prager the attribution for coming up with the American Trinity. Now, the leftist trinity is first and foremost, divide and conquer. It's not e pluribus unum. It's not out of many one. It's divide and conquer. That's where we get identity politics from. Identity politics is a strain from the train of thought of postmodernism. Essentially, that the individual does not matter. It's the collective and your tribal group that matters. That's why you constantly see the left try to have movements that divide people, rich versus poor in Occupy Wall Street, police versus citizens in the Black Lives Matter movement, or more recently, men versus women in the Me Too movement. It seems as if there's always movements that are trying to pit people against each other instead of unify them together. And here's Stacey Abrams. She said, "This is why we won." Now, I'd have more respect for her if she said, "Identity politics is who we are, and that's exactly why we lost," because she lost the race. She still hasn't conceded. And she lost by 55,000 votes, actually, just so you understand. 55,000 votes, and she still thinks she won. Or maybe it was Russia for the reason that she lost the 2018 midterm election. Not totally sure. But identity politics is one of the most dangerous trends in America because essentially what it means that things that you cannot control matter more than things you can control. That's what identity politics is all about. Skin color matters more than character. Gender matters more than course of action. That is why identity politics is so dangerous, because it releases people from responsibility. If it does not matter how you act, it does not matter your content, it does not matter your value system, it just matters your skin color or your gender, then all of a sudden it releases people from actually caring about how they act and caring about what they think. And it matters more about their tribal identity group and puts people in very segregated communities. It resegregates people unnecessarily. Stacey Abrams praises this as saying, again, I have to reread this quote. I can't say it without laughing. I would argue that identity politics is exactly who we are and exactly how we won. By centering communities in Georgia, we not only increased voter participation, we brought new folks to the process. That's why she lost by 50,000 votes, but she believed she won. Congratulations, Stacey Abrams, for the dumbest political statement of the week. So thank you, Stacey Abrams, for getting us off the starting block here. Producer Andrew, what you got for our AMA?
You know, we're getting out of the gate strong here, going straight for some controversial topics.
Allegedly controversial.
Allegedly. Depends where you're coming
word,
from.
Allegedly.
Allegedly controversial topics here on the Charlie Kirk Show. Rebecca from Wisconsin has a question about abortion.
Now, before we get to the question, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please, two things. Press subscribe, 5-star rating, leave a review. That's where these questions are coming from. So give us that 5-star rating, please. It really helps us climb in the rankings and go up against these far left-wing podcasts. So please press subscribe, 5-star rating. Producer Andrew.
So the question again is from Rebecca in Wisconsin and has to deal with the allegedly controversial topic of abortion. And the question goes like this. If a woman is allowed to terminate the life of a child because she does not want that child, shouldn't men also be allowed to opt out of paying child support if it's a pregnancy they did not want either?
Well, so I'm gonna phrase this in a way that uses the left's own terms against them. And I'm not going to say this is what I believe, but it's going to be a thought exercise for people to use, okay? So the left believes that the fetus or the baby, I call it a baby, but a fetus is a human life. It's just another description for a human life within the woman, is a piece of property, right, Andrew? They say that it's a piece of property that can be disposed of because it's not a human life.
Something along those lines,
right.
Certainly. Yeah.
So, because it's definitely not a human life, so it's something that could be disposed of. Okay, actually go to the medical science behind it. How much percent is that baby under the law actually the father's, and what percent is the mother's? Because when the baby is born, it's 50-50. Right? When the baby is born, it's just as much the father's child as it is the mother's child. You actually go to the science of it, it reaffirms it. Just as much of the DNA creation is the father's as it is the mother's. So you go to the actual blending of the sperm and the egg, it's 50-50. And so one would make the argument, the scientific argument, that the woman is nothing more than the host. Now, the host is important. I'm not trying to diminish that. But the baby is developing within the woman. It is not the woman's body. It is another body within her. But let's go back to this argument. If it is a piece of property, like the left says it is, and the woman has complete and total domain over it, which I don't accept— but if we go to the argument that it's 50% the man's and 50% the woman's, why is it only the woman's decision to dispose of that piece of property?
Well, you can't tell a woman what to do with her body, Charlie.
But the argument would be, isn't it half the woman's and half the man's piece of property? Because it's half the man's DNA that's being disposed of without him even being notified. And so a more interesting thought exercise to do is, what if you had to get the man to sign off on an abortion? Now, obviously, you have exceptions for rape and incest and those, you know, sexual assault.
Health of the mother,
which, by the way, I'll actually read the statistics in a second, is a rarity. The Florida abortion statistics came out. So mind you, Alyssa Milano goes on television on CNN when the new abortion law gets passed, and she completely and totally demagogues the abortion debate. She says Republicans don't want women that get raped to be able to have abortions. Well, first of all, I actually do believe in those exceptions. Some Republicans and conservatives don't. I do believe in those exceptions. But let me read you some statistics. Out of 71,740 abortions in Florida, 0.001% were due to incest, 0.065% to protect the mother's life, 0.058% due to rape, 0.668% for fetal abnormalities.
Abnormalities.
Yeah, it's a tough word to say. 98.6% were elective procedures for social or economic reasons. So we're talking about such a small, finite percentage of the argument that actually gets focused on a majority of the conversation. But I do not believe that people should be able to dismiss another human life just because they don't want that life. And I sent out a tweet the other day that went totally viral, talking about the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of American families that are waiting in line for adoption. There are so many Americans that were not given the blessing of being able to have children, that were not given the opportunity to be able to procreate on their own, and they have to wait. It's very expensive, by the way. And so I think that we should completely and totally defund Planned Parenthood, the $500 million a year, and redirect that $500 million to adoption. Why not have planned adoption? Isn't that what real Planned Parenthood should be? Like they capture this word, Planned Parenthood. It sounds so nice. Who doesn't want Planned Parenthood? No one wants unplanned parenthood, right? Isn't the left, they're so good at capturing these agreeable terms for things that are actually inherently divisive. And I think we should redirect that money towards adoption services. I think that the conservative movement, us that are pro-life, we don't talk enough about adoption. I think adoption is a beautiful thing. By the way, our adoption laws are totally screwed up. The waiting periods, the expense around it. There are so many families that get pushed out of the adoption process because of how expensive it is, the lawyers they have to hire, and the things surrounding it. And so the thought process for those listening is, if it is actually half the man's and half the woman's deoxyribonucleic acid, that's a very fancy term for DNA, in the child, because when that child is born, it is half and half, should the woman be able to get an abortion without the man actually agreeing to it? And I'm not saying I believe in that. I'm not at all. I'm saying that's a thought exercise that you should be able to consider, because the left views the fetus as nothing more than a piece of property that can be disposed of.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting too that,
and again,
you
just for Media Matters listening to this, I'm using it as a thought exercise. Right, Andrew?
It's right. It's a thought exercise.
And I was very clear. I do believe in exceptions for rape, for incest, life of the mother and health of the mother, which is less than 2% of all abortions.
Right. Well, I think you touched on something really interesting with Planned Parenthood. You know, it's a deception from the very beginning, from the name, from the branding, right?
Sure.
Planned Parenthood. It's actually planned abortion, planned termination of parenthood.
Well, as my great friend Lila Rose says, it doesn't help plan for parenthood. It helps people escape it.
That's right.
Planned Parenthood, they actually provide very, very little health care, very small percentage of adoption referrals, less than 2% of all the nation's cancer screenings per year were actually done by Planned Parenthood, and they say that's a big part of what they do. 321,000 abortions a year through Planned Parenthood, and we give them $500 million a year. $500 million a year. Just giving an example of how much 321,000 abortions is a year, that's St. Louis wiped out every single year. Isn't that stunning? That 321,000 lives that are not allowed the opportunity to exist, to flourish. And so people say, Charlie, why do you care about that child? Well, because we care about the sovereignty of the individual. That if you are taking away that individual's potential, you are then saying my life, my decisions are more important than another person. You're then value imposing on another person. Isn't that everything the left says they don't want? Doesn't the left always say, well, don't tell me how to live my life? Well, you're telling another person how to not live theirs by ending their life. Just to give you another idea, that's 880 abortions every single day. And just the cumulative numbers since Roe versus Wade, interesting, we'll talk about Roe versus Wade in a second, that's 60 million abortions since Roe versus Wade. That's 60 million lives that never had the opportunity to flourish. What if we aborted someone who could have had a breakthrough cancer drug? What if we aborted someone that could have led a peaceful political movement that would have brought us together?
Well, I always think about this in terms of Steve Jobs was very well could have been aborted. Yeah, exactly. How many Steve Jobs have been killed since the beginning of Roe v. Wade?
And so we as center-right conservatives, libertarians, whatever you want to call us. I call myself a conservatarian, and we went through that in the first episode. Encourage all of you to go back and listen to that episode, Why I Believe What I Believe, and of course give us 5 stars, is we believe that every individual can flourish above the level that they are today. And abortion robs people of that opportunity. And so the other part of this, Roe versus Wade, it's really interesting. The woman that was actually used in Roe versus Wade later became a pro-life activist, and she said she was used just for political purposes to advance the abortion industry. And that's really what this is. This is an abortion industry. It's a multi-billion dollar machine where the abortionists, the abortion doctors, the people that own the clinics, the people that have contracts for the clinics make so much money. And isn't it a sad state of affairs, Andrew, that there's an entire industry in America that makes money off of terminating the life of certain individuals? And here's another couple questions about abortion that people should think about. Number one, why do we have universally agreed upon standards of when life ends? We offer a death certificate when life ends. We do not have universally agreed upon standards of when life begins. Do not say life begins when the baby comes out of the womb. That is not – I mean, anyone who has that position believes that abortion right up to the dilation is legal, which, by the way, is the position of the Democrat Party in New York and Virginia. The second question that people accuse me of just using semantics, but language matters. Language is the map of which we navigate our values. Why do we say when someone is pregnant, hey, how's your baby or when's your baby due? Not, hey, when's your fetus due? Or how's your fetus doing? Or what are you going to name your fetus? We recognize it as a baby, as a child. Kim Kardashian, who's a Planned Parenthood activist. Alyssa Milano, who's a Planned Parenthood activist. You can go back to their Twitter posts and their Instagram posts when they were celebrating their pregnancy. They said, hey, come to my baby shower. They never said, come to my fetus shower. They said, I can't wait for our expecting child. They recognize there's something within them that is a human life. And why is someone able to have a celebration of a pregnancy, which we don't call, what do we call that? We call it a baby shower, not a fetus shower. Why are they able to have a baby shower and everyone celebrates the pregnancy and they bring them gifts and they might have a gender reveal? And then what if the woman right after that ceremony goes and has an abortion? Does that all of a sudden make that life more or less alive? Or does you make that human more or less alive? The essence of it is this. A human life should not be subject to another person's circumstance or subjectivity. Instead, you should have objective standards of life where we say, yes, this is a human being that should be preserved and protected and their rights with, honestly, to use a word I used before, protected up against anyone that might want to violate them. So before we take some more questions, here's why I'm a big fan of Simply Safe Home Security. Simply Safe is ready for anything that gets thrown at it. If a storm takes out your power, Simply Safe is ready. If an intruder cuts your phone line, Simply Safe is ready. Say they destroy your keypad or siren, Simply Safe will still get you the help you need. Here's what I love about this. Maybe it's overkill. Maybe you don't need to be ready for every worst case scenario, but Simply Safe is always ready just in case. That's what makes it great. Now, Simply Safe could cost an arm and a leg. It should, but it doesn't. And that's because they're good people. They charge you what's fair, what's right, $14.99 a month. I use this, and you should use it too. No contracts, no hidden fees. Go to simplysafe.com/Charlie. That's simplysafe.com/Charlie. You will use the same security system that I'm using. I totally, completely endorse it. You've got to check it out. All right, we're back. Producer Andrew, what do we got? Again, this is the AMA's bonus episode, Charlie Kirk Show. If you're listening, give us those 5 stars. We're at a 5-star rally right now on Apple Podcast. Here we go, Andrew.
That's right. Christina on Facebook says, sort of related question about abortion, but she says, why is it okay for abortions to happen, but not okay for a woman to use a gun to protect herself? So sort of a connected idea.
Well, I mean, I think what she's doing is she's pantomiming a liberal talking point, right, Andrew? I think that's what she's kind of mocking.
She's being ironic.
Yeah, she's trying to draw facetious. That's a better word. Well, I mean, the answer is we believe that the baby should be protected and you should be able to have a firearm to protect yourself. It's really interesting in the kind of gun control debate how often people don't realize that it's actually women that are the most likely to purchase firearms right now, that the most NRA membership has actually been – I can get the exact numbers, but somewhere between 70-80% of new NRA members under the age of 40 have been young women. And so let's play this out. Let's play out one of the leftist talking points to its further extent, and then let's walk it backwards with a solution to their own insanity, okay? So there's a huge movement right now around Me Too. And look, I think if men engage in that kind of behavior, they should be held accountable against the law. They should go to prison. People like Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby, I'm not ever trying to cheapen that in whatsoever. However, they, I believe, misrepresent statistics to make it seem as if that college campuses have a higher sexual assault and rape incident than the Congo, which, as Heather McDonald says, that's not even close to being true. And again, they're saying that 1 in 4 women in college will be sexually assaulted. And if you actually look at the data, that's just not true. It's just not. But let's pretend it's true. Let's pretend it's true. And again, I'm not trying to cheapen or diminish that, because I know a lot of people that have been sexually assaulted and very good friends that have gone through that horrendous, horrendous thing. And I'll tell you how now they live with it and how they react to it. They bought a firearm. And so if you take the left's talking point to its furthest extent, that there is an unbelievably dangerous world out there, that women are being subjected to this horrendous criminal activity on college campuses and other places, Andrew, wouldn't it make sense that we should increase firearm ownership for women? Because guns are the great equalizer. If you actually look at a woman with a Glock, that would put her up against any sort of 300, 400-pound guy that might want to do harm to her. And that's why I'm such a big defender of the Second Amendment. And there was this great video clip I put on my Twitter a couple weeks ago of this woman that was walking down an alley, and a guy gets out of a car and tries to steal something from her. She takes out a gun seamlessly, shoots him twice in the leg, and that was about it. And so we have our Young Women's Leadership Summit coming up at Turning Point USA, tpusa.com. We'll have over 1,000 young women from all across the country, 50 states represented. And one of the biggest issues that the young women at our events that gets them excited is legal firearm ownership. It is the great equalizer. And people like Katie Pavlich and many others talk about this, that if the left was actually correct, let's pretend they are, that we live in this environment where 1 out of 4 college women are going to be sexually assaulted or raped, which, again, what parent would send their daughter to college if that was actually true? And that's what Heather McDonald extrapolates to the data. It's just not correct at all. And they've moved the goalposts. They've moved the data sets. However, if that was true, then you should equip young women with the capacity to be able to defend themselves against someone where there's such physical inequality. Because, I mean, no matter what you argue, men are going to be bigger. They're going to be more aggressive than young women. And so you have a 5'2" young lady in college who's 19 years old. Well, if she has a firearm, she'll be able to protect herself against something that bad that happens to her.
Well, you know, it's one of those issues, too, that I think would surprise a lot of people. If you go on social media, just look around a little bit. A lot of young women in the conservative movement, I mean, it's a massive trend.
It's a huge trend.
Just go on social media. I just challenge anybody here listening who's not aware, go on social media. You'll find dozens and dozens and dozens of influencers, as we call them, that are promoting firearm and firearm safety.
Let me just read you some stats. There's been a 77% in female gun ownership since 2005. It is the fastest growing demographic within shooting. There are over 5.4 million women who target shoot regularly. That means at least once a month. This is a huge increase, and I don't think that story gets out very often. And for whatever reason, it seems as if the stigma is that only men should own firearms, which is obviously not true.
Well, so actually, we have another gun question, Charlie, while we're sort of on the topic. This is Richard. Richard's asking about just the increase. I'm going to paraphrase his question for him, about the increase in deaths from gun violence in America. Isn't that an argument against gun ownership in the Second Amendment? Just how many deaths there are every year?
Well, so let's actually break down the gun statistic deaths in America. So there's roughly 33,000, right, Andrew? 33,000 gun deaths per year?
It's over 30K. That's right.
So when it comes to the gun debate in America, there's so much misrepresentation. So first of all, let's just take 2016. The number is startling, and you hear this number recited and repeated by many politicians. 33,594 gun deaths in 2016. Like, wow, that's a lot. I mean, it is a lot. But 22,938 of them were death by suicide. We are the only country in the world that counts death with a gun and suicide as a gun death. The only country in the industrialized world. So let's just factor that. I mean, I'm not trying to diminish death by suicide. I've had friends that have committed suicide, and suicide's a very serious, real thing. But I think we would all agree that there's something deeper than just a firearm at play when someone commits suicide with a gun, that there's a deeper mental health issue and something that needs to be addressed. And so then that leaves 14,415 homicides in 2016. If I were to ask somebody, what out of that 14,415, what number do you think was mass shootings?
No idea.
71. 71 out of 14,415 in 2016 were mass shootings. Now, there's actually a very specific definition of what a mass shooting is. I think it's three or more people killed. I think so. So 14,415, you subtract that by 71. Where's the rest of this number come from? Well, about 1% of that number is rightful means of self-defense, about 1% of that number. So people that defended themselves, and that's actually not a murder, that's gun death. Another part of that, about 2%, is accidental just discharges. So people that were not taking care of their gun or they were cleaning it improperly and they died because of that, which is horrific. And that's a responsibility issue more than anything else. The same could happen with a ladder outside of your house when you're cleaning the yard. The same could happen with a chainsaw. Just because you did it with a gun does not mean it's a gun problem. But a majority of that, Andrew, 80%, 90%, I can get the exact number, are with handguns, and they're gang-related violence with men between the ages of 18 and 30 in urban areas. That's where 80% of the gun deaths in our country actually happen, is in very densely populated urban areas where there's two big common denominators, failing public schools and failing government programs. You tie those two things together, you have a pattern of gun violence and violence altogether that, quite frankly, makes it seem as if we have a gun epidemic in America. And there's this great op-ed, and I'm going to find it right here, that essentially I used to support gun control, and then I found the statistics, and now I don't. And there's a Washington Post, October 3rd, 2017, written by Leah Libresco, quote, the top of it, "I used to think gun control is the answer. My research told me otherwise." It's one of the most amazing pieces, Washington Post. Can't believe they published it, October 3rd, 2017. And you read this, and she says, she goes through the whole thing, death by suicide, who actually are the ones that are contributing to the murder rate. And she says the largest set of deaths outside of suicide were young men ages 15 to 34 killed in homicides in urban areas. And it's the more you look into this data, the more information you get, the more context you can get, just away from confiscate all the guns, take things away from people. And look, here's what people have to realize, is there is always a price to liberty. There's a price to having the liberty of cars. There's a price to having the liberty of planes. There's a cost to having the liberty of buying alcohol. The cost is that some people will abuse that liberty and abuse that freedom. And unfortunately, with firearms, it gets very politicized very quickly, where people immediately want to confiscate other people's firearms for their own political purposes, even when the vast majority, 300 million guns and over 100 million gun owners, did nothing wrong. And they peacefully stored them in a safe. They registered them properly. And they did nothing to contribute to a crime whatsoever.
I think you're touching on something there as well, how so much of the gun debate is emotional. So much is what they see on TV and these horrific school
and
shootings. And we need to have a conversation about what's happening at our schools, of course, certainly. But, you know, when you hear something like the Crime Prevention Research Center saying that over 50% of murders occur in 2% of the nation's 3,142 counties. Mm-hmm. So 2% of our counties account for over half of the murders that occur in this country.
It's a very, very centralized thing.
And of those, 15 to 33%, according to the Justice's National Gang Center, Department of Justice's National Gang Center, rather, 15 to 33% are all related to drugs and gang activity.
Which again, you have to go to the root causes of why that's actually happening. Why do people join gangs? Because families are broken apart. Why do they stay in gangs? Well, because our schools are failing. If we could fix our schools through a national school choice program and a national voucher program, which we talked about in a previous AMA, I encourage everyone to go back to the one we had in Phoenix, where I talked about why we should be able to fire bad teachers and pay good teachers more and allow parents to send their kids to better schools. And our public education system has been a total and dismal failure. It's a civil rights catastrophe of our time. And it's not because of lack of funding. We've spent trillions of dollars on our public education system, and we have basically nothing to show for it in a lot of our schools. There are entire school systems, there are entire school areas that – school systems, I should say – where kids, they couldn't find one kid that could read at grade level. Not one kid at grade level. And so you have these systemic reasons for violence, then all of a sudden you blame the gun. And so there's a website I always go to. I'm a native Chicagoan, go Cubs. And just right now, year to date, 167 people have been shot and killed in Chicago. 677 people have been shot and wounded in Chicago. 844 people have been shot year to date. And 180 homicides, with the strictest gun laws in the country. A report released in 2017 found that 13 high schools in Baltimore had zero students proficient in math. I want to say that again. A report in 2017 found 13 high schools in Baltimore that had zero students proficient in math. 90% of black boys in Baltimore schools cannot read at grade level, yet no teachers are being fired. No teachers are being held accountable for this failure. We just keep sending money, and we keep sending money to administrators. None of these schools are closing, and they should be. Close the schools, open new charter ones, send them to private schools, give them a voucher to get out of there. And what if you cannot read, and if you cannot do math at grade level, sure, you're much more likely to join a gang. You're much more likely to get into horrific criminal activity. We have to get to the systemic reasons this is happening. And this is something the left always talks about. Like, well, we have to realize the systemic inequality in it. Well, I agree. It's your own programs that have screwed up these inner cities.
And conservatives always get hit with, you know, you're hard, you're callous, what this and that and the other. But it's actually, there's a lot of compassion involved
seeing
a failing system.
I care about I'm a Christian. I care about our fellow brothers and sisters of the inner city.
The least of these, yeah.
You know, the last time there was a Republican mayor in Atlanta, 1879. The last time there was a Republican mayor in Chicago, 1931. The last time there was a Republican mayor in Baltimore, 1967. The last time there was a Republican mayor in Detroit, 1962. The last time there was a Republican mayor in New Orleans, 1872. Pittsburgh, 1934. Seattle, 1946. Philadelphia, 1952. Cincinnati, 1971. No wonder why all these cities have failing schools, high crime, and poverty. You can't blame Republicans for cities that we've never governed. List of America's deadliest cities: St. Louis, Baltimore, Detroit, New Orleans, Birmingham, Jackson, Baton Rouge, Hartford, Salinas, California, Milwaukee, Chicago, all run by Democrats. We don't need gun control, Andrew. We need Democrat control. All right, well, that's a good place to leave it. Getting fit and staying healthy always sounds easier said than done, right? OpenFit is bringing you something new that makes it even easier to never miss a sweat session or a workout. As I've mentioned a couple times before, I had a horrible back injury in January, and staying on schedule, staying regimented is a huge deal. I travel all the time. OpenFit helps me get that done. OpenFit takes all the complexity out of losing weight and getting fit. It's brand new, super simple streaming service that allows you to work out from the comfort of your living room in as little as 10 minutes a day. Everyone's bodies are different, and OpenFit gets that, which is why it is personalized to your needs with a custom-tailored original content. It's super simple. Forget all the complexity and stress around getting fit and just press play and work out on your schedule. 600 seconds with celebrity trainer Devin Wiggins packs the fat burning, muscle building, and body sculpting benefits of a much longer session into a fraction of that time. It's results you can see. Lose up to 15 pounds in just 30 days, flatten your abs, shape your body, look and feel great. I love OpenFit. It keeps me disciplined. It keeps me on schedule. Working out is something that I know a lot of people want to do. This will make sure you get it done. OpenFit has changed the way I work out. Use my code Kirk. Go to OpenFit and use my code Kirk, K-I-R-K. You can join me on a fitness journey personalized just for you. Again, use my code Kirk, K-I-R-K, and start using OpenFit for your journey to a healthier life. Right now, during the OpenFit 30-Day Challenge, my listeners get a special extended 30-day trial membership to OpenFit, where you can lose up to 15 pounds in 30 days when you text Kirk, K-I-R-K, to 30-30-30. That's 30-30-30. You'll get full access to OpenFit, all the workouts and nutrition information totally free. Again, just text Kirk, K-I-R-K, to 30-30-30. Standard message and data rates may apply. Now we're back. Andrew, producer Andrew, what else you got?
All right, we got Brandon from Austin, who says, we often talk about illegal immigration, but what about legal immigration? The population in my state of Texas has increased dramatically in the last few decades, both from in-country immigration from states like California, as well as from Latin America. Should we be worried about population size, and how much legal immigration is enough?
So, great question. Look, this is actually kind of becoming more hotly debated. So I am so against illegal immigration. I don't even call it illegal immigration. I think that immigration means that you obey the law, you wait in line, and you come to this country correctly. Illegals are line cutting and border jumping. But this is the disagreement I have with a lot of some people on the right, and this is kind of a growing contingent on the right, and producer Andrew actually might be in this category, who knows, which is there's this organization, and I have respect for a lot of what they talk about. I'm not trying to diminish them or belittle them. I just disagree with them, and disagreement's fine, called Numbers USA. And they run these ads saying, we want to restrict the amount of legal immigrants in our country, as if aspirational, qualified, intelligent people coming to America would be a net negative. And there's no evidence of that whatsoever. It's not like we have a lack of land or a lack of resources in this country. There's certain parts of the country that are probably overpopulated, LA County, thinking of one. There's parts of this country that could be benefited by 5,000 new, ambitious, young, ethical immigrants from all over the world. And so I'm actually of the opinion that we should be the Kentucky basketball of immigrants. Now, what do I mean by that? Those of you that don't understand the sports reference, they go and search out Kentucky basketball every year, the best basketball players in the country and the best talent. We should be no different. We should have the most talented, ambitious people in the world coming to America. Now, we have a specific type of visa. The EB-5 visa allows you to come in with resources, create jobs, buy property, maybe a hotel, and all of a sudden you get permanent residency. This is a great part of our immigration system. We should expand that, and that we should make it easier for people to bring their money into America. The same should be said, though, for the genius visa. If you're coming to be educated in America, you should be able to stay in America. If you go to Stanford, if you go to Yale, if you go to Harvard, why would we educate the best and brightest of the world and then export them back to the country that they came from, export them back to Eastern Europe or to Africa or wherever? It doesn't make any sense. We should want them to stay here in America. I'll give you a couple myths. We do not have an overpopulation problem in this country. Certain parts of the country can probably be too densely populated. But right now, just so you know, Chicago, Illinois, Cook County, lost 56,000 people over the last 10 years. Why is Illinois losing its grip? Because of bad politics and bad policy? But if you have 10,000 immigrants that come maybe with a little bit of money, a lot of ambition and great ideas, Illinois could be turned around. And so I know that a lot of the policy, a lot of the concern about overpopulation comes from people in LA, and producer Andrew lives in LA, and I understand it's
traffic is real.
The traffic and the schools and all, I get all that. But there's parts of this country that are losing population. Actually, for the first time since the census, North Dakota and South Dakota are increasing in population, and Cook County is decreasing in population. Cook County, Chicago. I want you to think about this. Cook County, Chicago, where it's the headquarters of Boeing, the headquarters of United Airlines, the headquarters of Allstate Insurance, lost 56,000 people over 10 years. That's amazing. With all the births and all the people still moving there, that means that there's just a net migration out of Illinois, and I'm one of them. I'm getting out as quickly as I possibly can. So there are parts of this country that would be benefited from a ambitious and aspirational group of immigrants that are going to obey the law, they'll create jobs, they'll be entrepreneurs, they'll go to school, and they'll be able to participate in a market economy. Right now, Andrew, we have more job openings than we have people to fill them in America right now. And that's because our economy is doing so well. I say we need more legal immigrants to come to this country. I'll give you some examples. Elon Musk came as an illegal immigrant, a legal immigrant. Peter Thiel. These people came as legal immigrants to our country, and they obeyed the law and were better because of it.
You know, it is interesting. You touched on something right there about people moving around in the country legally, right? So people are leaving places like California, they're leaving places like Illinois, and they're going to places like Texas, like
well, they're going to more
Arizona.
Freedom-based states, exactly. And there are parts of this country, I mean, Texas could take another 5 million legal immigrants. When you go to these parts of Texas, they are starving for high-quality talent that will come to their state.
There's a lot of people, though, that are also worried about this, right? It's causing a lot of consternation about Texas turning blue because of all the Californians coming.
Well, look, here's the one thing. You should not craft immigration policy around how you think people are going to vote. That's not a good idea. That's what the left does, and we accuse them of that. That's why they want illegals, right? So you should – that might be a byproduct, might be a logical conclusion of a lot of these things, but we should be – what's best for the country? Okay, so 100,000 people that bring money – and bring a high intellect and bring ambition with them is nothing but positive. And this is not a relatively new concept. Merit-based immigration is the standard of a lot of these countries that the left holds up as the greatest countries in the world. Switzerland, they will not let you into Switzerland unless you have no debt, a certain net worth, and no crime whatsoever. Switzerland's always held up as this great socialist example when, in fact, Switzerland is actually much more free market than America is. Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Sweden up until late. Sweden has totally screwed themselves up because of unlimited immigration to their country. And that's not what I'm advocating at all. But there are people right now. There are young people. There are 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds all across the world, from India, from Indonesia, in Somalia, that would give anything for a chance to come to America, and they would obey our laws, and our country would be better because of it. We need those people here. We should want those people there, and that's here, and this is exactly why I advocate for that type of immigration.
You know, there's some interesting numbers from Pew. They say that, according to Pew, the U.S. has more immigrants than any other country in the world. As of 2015, the United Nations estimates that 46.6 million people living in the United States were not born here.
No, by far. And so not only that, we take in half of the world's immigrants every single year. So we have 5% of the world's population, and we take in 50% of the world's immigrants. So if you have five fingers, everyone listening to this can hold up five fingers. Your first two fingers right there are Indian Chinese. That's the world population. One out of five of people in the world are Chinese. The other one out of five are Indian. So two out of five of the people in the world are either Indian or Chinese. It's amazing to think about, isn't it? We like to think as if America has a lot of people. We really don't. We have 340 million people. That's 5% of the entire world. Most of the world is Indian and Chinese. Most of the world's actually in Asia. If you count India and China both in Asia, plus the Philippines, plus Indonesia, plus Korea, plus Japan, you're looking at about 2.7, 2.8 billion people just in Asia alone. Not to mention Iran and the Middle East. There's a billion people about in the Middle East altogether. And so America has 5% of the world's population, yet we take in 50%, half of the world's immigrants every single year. Japan does not even have an immigration policy. And actually, I could argue that a lot of these countries that don't want to bring in the best and brightest and aspirational and forward-thinking and productive people, they're worse off because of it long-term. I think Japan has actually slipped from the global competitiveness stage because of their lack of embrace of a legal immigrant program that allows people to start with nothing and create something with aspiration and ambition, work ethic, and entrepreneurship.
America is a unique challenge when we're talking about immigration as well, in the sense that we are big enough as a country from East Coast to West Coast, North to South, to have internal immigration that also causes upheaval and change to different cities, right?
You mean illegal immigration?
No, I'm talking about legal in-country immigration.
Well, this is really interesting. I mean, this is what we call what Louis Brandeis called the laboratories of democracy, essentially seeing how different states can implement different policies, and you'll see the movement of people. And Illinois is the greatest test case of this. Illinois should be one of the most prosperous, most fiscally sound states in the country. I grew up in Illinois. I love it to death, but it's becoming unsustainable. They're doing nothing but raising taxes. Their pensions are a complete and total joke. And every other neighboring state to Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, Missouri, Michigan. Michigan's not neighboring and not touching it, but it's neighboring it. You can get to Michigan in 30 minutes from Chicago. They are booming and prospering on the backs of the Midwest, on the backs of Illinois, I should say. And so look, what's really interesting is you see now people going to Tennessee, you see people going to Texas, you see people going to Florida. Well, what does Texas, Tennessee, and Florida all have in common? Low income tax, manageable cost of living, and a free enterprise booming economy. And you see the exact opposite from states like Connecticut and Illinois, states with high taxes, with poorly run urban center public schools, and corrupt Democrat politicians that have run these states endlessly for years and years and years. Before we get to the next one, I want to let you know about a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to meet President Trump and win the millionth Make America Great Again hat, personally signed by President Trump, our great, successful, incredible president. The president is holding a contest where you, yes you, could win the 1 millionth MAGA hat. I already have a couple MAGA hats. It's terrific. You got to enter. President Trump is going to pick one lucky winner to fly out to a rally where they'll get a full VIP access and the president will hand deliver the hat. All you have to do, it's free. This is free to enter. All you have to do is text RED HAT to 88022. That's RED HAT to 88022. I've done this. You have to subscribe. You get great alerts to it. If you win, you'll be flown out to an upcoming rally to receive the 1 millionth MAGA hat that was signed by President Trump. They'll even pay for your flight, hotel, and you'll get a picture with the president. Again, all you have to do is text RED HAT to 88022. That's RED HAT to 88022 to win the 1 millionth Make America Great Again hat signed by President Trump. This is paid for by the Trump Make America Great Again Committee, a joint fundraising committee authorized by and composed of Donald J. Trump for President, Inc., and the Republican National Committee that is dedicated to making America great again. All right, we're back. And I just want to say this. Anyone listening to this might want to get involved in the fight on college campuses. Go to tpusa.com. Get involved with Turning Point USA. We have some super exciting conferences coming up this summer. Young Women's Leadership Summit, our Teenage Student Action Summit coming up in July. You can apply at tpusa.com. Andrew, what do you got?
Beth asks, how do you reconcile your faith informing your politics with the very American idea of the separation of church and state?
Yeah, and so thank you. Great question. I mean, my faith is the most important thing in my life and my Christian walk and my Christian beliefs. However, when dealing with public policy, it's really important to never argue through things through a theocratic lens or as if you're arguing for a theocracy. So every one of my beliefs, my belief on abortion, my belief on judges, my belief on religious liberty, has to be argued and is rooted actually from a secular viewpoint. Now, of course, my values come from a Christian worldview, compassion and benevolence and generosity, being productive and working hard. But when I actually argue for public policy, everything has to go through a lens as if someone doesn't share that same Christian worldview. Instead, it comes from agreeable morality of which Western civilization has been built on. So don't take other people's stuff, allow people to be free. So I'll give you a great example. When I gave the whole abortion argument earlier in the show, I never once cited the Bible. I didn't once cite my own Christian philosophy or belief. Now, if I was talking to a church, I might do that if I was trying to convince them that being against abortion was the Christian thing. I might only use the Old Testament if I was talking to a synagogue and I was trying to convince them that being against abortion was something that was consistent with the Torah or consistent with Jewish teaching. However, it's really important that that Christians or that anyone in the political sphere does not use your own religious doctrine to advance political philosophy. And I'll give you a great example. We would be up in arms if someone like Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar started to use the Quran to try to justify their own public policy objectives. And so we should always argue for things through a secular lens because most of America right now does not share our own Christian beliefs. And you have to have a government that is for all people, that is representative of all your citizens. And because of that, you should have the freedom to pursue your own religious liberty, your own religious exercise, and your own religious practice. And under the viewpoint that I espouse, which is you can do whatever you want to do, as how you want to do it, as long as it doesn't harm somebody else, but you have to take responsibility for your actions, and then argue for everything through the lens that is agreeable for people that do not have the same religious beliefs that you have.
Got a really, really intense final question, Charlie.
Here we are.
What is the better show, Game of Thrones or Breaking Bad? This is from Robert in Iowa.
So I have to say, I mean, look, I actually was a fan of this last season of Game of Thrones. I mean, everyone thought it was horrible. I actually thought the last episode was the worst part of all of it. I love when Daenerys Targaryen burned the entire city down.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
By the way,
assuming everybody has seen
it. Yeah, exactly. If you haven't seen it yet, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say I loved when she burned down the town because I don't like death and suffering media matters. I know you're listening to this. But I enjoyed the character arc because it actually made perfect sense to me. And let me walk through this because I actually don't think this argument was made. Daenerys Targaryen goes all the way across the sea to claim what she thought was hers. And she was ready to take on King's Landing. And what happens? Jon Snow interrupts her and says, yeah, you can't go fight the Lannisters. We got to go fight the dead. It would have been so easy for Daenerys Targaryen to tell Jon Snow to go pound snow. Get it? Pound sand.
Would have been in Dorne.
It would have been really easy. But let's walk through this. So Daenerys Targaryen made a selfless act, something that she did not have to do, which resulted in her losing one of her dragons to the enemy.
One of her children,
really. Losing a lot of her Dothraki legion, losing some of her best friends to go fight the dead for something bigger than what was even her. What does she get in return? She goes to find out that she actually isn't the true heir to the Iron Throne, that her love that she fell in love with was actually her relative. I think her uncle, or she was his aunt, right? That she was the aunt to him. So the whole thing was kind of incestuous, literally. And so then she loses a bunch of her loved ones. She loses one of her dragons to the Night King to have a totally depleted and diminished army. She's like, all right, we beat the Night King. Now can we finally go beat Cersei? And everyone's like, yeah, sure, that's great. So then she's just flying on a casual, beautiful King's Landing day, Dragonstone day. One of her dragons gets punched out of the sky by one of the guy from the Iron Islands, the defector. Euron, that's right. Euron Greyjoy, right? Euron Greyjoy, yeah. Euron Greyjoy, just a beautiful sniper shot. By the way, how he could hit that thing at going as fast as it was going, it doesn't. That was probably one of the most unrealistic things.
And then in the
dragons are more realistic than the fact.
And then in the next episode, it just has zero problem taking out all of them.
And so Daenerys, at this point, imagine this: you've lost your dragons, two of them. Jon Snow is nowhere to be seen, and now you're being asked to now take on Cersei. Then what happens? Melisandre, is that? Am I saying it right? Melisandre gets kidnapped and decapitated by Cersei. Cersei, who, by the way, is the one that's sitting on your Iron Throne. Cersei, who, by the way, her lover and brother was the one who backstabbed your father, remember?
And then she also promised to go up and help you fight
the dead and betrayed that. So how is she supposed to feel about all this? How's Daenerys? She feels like, I have nothing to lose. Never a good position to be in. Now, you calculate all this together. You actually look back in previous seasons. Daenerys was not always one to show restraint. She wasn't. They make it the character arc that is being misinterpreted online is as if Daenerys was always one that was very careful not to go after people. She crucified the slaveholders in Meereen.
Now she went looking for a fight again and again.
Always went after conflict. She went and indiscriminately burned the Tarwell family. Right? Remember, is that right? Tarwell.
Yeah.
Samwell. He killed all of them. She killed all of them as a complete. Total piece of retribution. And there was a beautiful line that was missed in the final episode, a beautiful line where I went, oh my goodness, this could have been shown even greater. Wasn't it Jon Snow that cut off a traitor's head and showed no mercy? Wasn't it Jon Snow as a Night Watch that executed someone who walked away and he cut off the head? Wasn't it the first episode ever of Game of Thrones that Ned Stark told the entire Stark boys that justice must be swift? When there was a defector from the Night's Watch, and it was Ned Stark who beheaded the defector. Remember that? There was no mercy. There was no forgiveness. Now, were the people of King's Landing innocent? Most of them absolutely were. But you look at it through this kind of little more interesting lens. She had a decision to make. The bells were ringing. Is Cersei really one that is ever going to surrender at any time? Cersei always has something up her sleeve. Cersei burned down the equivalent of a church. After her kids were the sept of Baelor, or something, right? Essentially, their equivalent of a religious institution. She burned it. Thousands of civilians died.
It was like the Vatican going down,
basically. And she blew up the whole thing. And then her son Tommen jumped out of a window right after that to fulfill the prophecy. So Daenerys had a decision to make. Now she probably could have done this a little more delicately, but I think it was an allusion to Dresden. I think that was kind of the distinction, the parallel that the writers...
You had an interesting take on this. Not many people have heard, so I think this is fascinating.
And so the writers drew this distinction, which was, so Daenerys was sitting on her dragon, and she had a decision to make. Accept the surrender of Cersei. Well, then what? Do you take her as prisoner? Do you publicly execute her? What about all the Lannister forces? You think they're really going to relinquish all the arms? And by the way, you go back to that Machiavellian dilemma. She knew she was not going to be loved. She knew she was not going to be loved when she was in Westeros. She knew that fear was the only way that she could have possibly governed the people of King's Landing and Westeros. Now, just like all lessons of history, power corrupts absolutely. And so then she goes way over bounds. But you know how many world leaders that we glamorize? And I love Winston Churchill that did that exact same thing. Winston Churchill killed anywhere between 20 to 100,000 civilians indiscriminately in the bombing of Dresden, using firebombing as a way to get back at the Nazi regime for what they did to London. Well, isn't that what Daenerys was doing? She was getting back at the Lannisters for all the pain and suffering of killing one of her dragon children, of not coming to the aid of the White Walkers that were going to kill her. Isn't that the kind of same moral lens that we look at a lot of our people through?
But I do think it's an interesting comment that was made in the last episode where Tyrion's actually talking to Jon Snow, and he says, Tywin, my father, was evil. Cersei, my sister, was evil. But you pile up all the bodies of the dead between them, and it doesn't come up to half of what Daenerys just did in King's Landing. So,
sure.
I mean, it was a massive...
It was a massacre. And I'm not just, obviously, I'm not justifying the action, but I'm saying she was put in a very difficult position. And the rational choice she made is that you can't do war halfway. And I know this is a difficult conversation for people to have in a mature society, but it was America that dropped two atomic bombs on Japan indiscriminately in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where 100,000 civilians were killed. You can look at the actual numbers. It was probably at least 100,000 civilians that were killed. I actually was against the dropping of the atomic bombs. So the idea...
Well, that you are in retrospect, certainly. Yeah, I mean, and I...
No, I'm comparing it. I'm comparing that in times of war, carpet bombing and the idea of indiscriminate killing has been used by our own country and been used by functional societies that we consider to be functioning and moral today, that were embraced by the UK and embraced by the United States at the
time.
You're
one of the most anti-war people, I think, you know, that's
out
there.
I think war's horrible. Yeah. I mean, I'm unbelievably vocal against conflict in Iran right now or conflict in Venezuela. I mean, war's a horrible thing. And so I think what was really interesting and really instructive, and I want to give praise to the Game of Thrones writers here, is they had an opportunity because they said 1 billion people are going to watch this or something crazy like that, right, Andrew? Like 1 billion people or something. Let's pretend it's half that.
It's a lot.
A lot of people. They had an opportunity to show the horror of war, and I actually appreciate that they did that. I think they had an opportunity to show what suffering – because I think, unfortunately, too often, movies glamorize conflict. Like, oh, there's the conqueror. Imagine how this would have been different if they actually didn't show the charred bodies and they didn't show the personal connection that Arya had with the fleeing mother and her child. You all of a sudden fell in love with that one character, and then boom, it disappears like that. And I think the Game of Thrones writers did a great service to society. Like, I actually think they did service to society to show that war is not a beautiful, good thing.
Well, and Weiss and Benioff actually had, you know, after the episode in their analysis of the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones, talked about how they made a conscious decision to follow Arya through the burning rubble as it was happening.
Well,
so it personalized.
I didn't love what I was saying, but I love what they were doing. I love what they were doing because war is a horrific, horrible thing. It's like one of the worst things that human beings can ever engage in is all-out war like that. And so maybe if we have millions more people that are less likely or less gun, you know, that don't want to go to war after seeing that, I think that's a good thing. Because whether it be dragons breathing fire on a city or Tomahawk missiles being launched into a country, it's very similar. And I think there's other ways to go about it. Daenerys was left with a really uncomfortable position there because she knew this. If she would have accepted the surrender of Cersei, she would not have seen that Iron Throne. She knew it immediately. Because Jon Snow would have had the momentum of the people around him. And look at the dynamics. If she would have actually had armed guards around her and disarmed Jon Snow before he entered the Iron Throne Pavilion, where he ended up, spoiler, killing Daenerys, which again, I didn't love that whole thing. I thought that was very...
I mean, I saw it coming a mile away. I mean, I have to
say. Oh, of course. But I didn't... I mean, I thought there was great irony in the whole thing, though, because, I mean, of course, the writers do all this. She burns the whole city down, then she dies on white snow. Kind of the Song of Fire and Ice was juxtaposed right there. And then the dragon burns down the entire Iron Throne. But do you think...
A little overwrought symbolism there. Yeah.
Oh, of course. But do you actually think that Daenerys in her head, do I want to be ruler of this land? And she thought of herself as the ultimate ruler. She thought of herself as someone who had the best ideas. This goes back to the idea of the philosopher king. Like, I just have to kill a couple more people and burn down a couple more villages, then everything's going to be okay. That idea of moral relativism, right? I'm not justifying it, but it's very accurate. It's very accurate in the sense of human history teaches us this happens time and time again. Yeah, just let me burn down a couple more villages.
I know better than everybody
else. I know better
than
everyone else. I mean, I have the better piece of morality than you do. Let me do this. And so from that sense, I actually appreciated the Game of Thrones story in this season a lot more than most. People said, it's horrible character arcs. I do think that they with Jaime was silly and stupid with Brienne of Tarth. Brienne was one of my favorite characters. I think they cheapened her horribly.
And then she just runs off to his sister.
That whole thing was just bizarre, and I just didn't like that. I think Bran becoming king, that didn't really make a lot of sense.
Although
to me.
That was the Vegas oddsmakers had that as the top,
okay,
the top choice.
So I have three really, really big questions about the end. Tyrion's in prison. All of a sudden, they all look to him to be in charge of who becomes king.
His beard was
was that the
formidable or
but
something.
Was that the weirdest thing? All of a sudden, he's in prison.
It was really abrupt.
They're about to kill him, and then he gives a speech, and everyone just allows to do it. Number two, this is my second question. Why is the North allowed to secede and no other territories are allowed to secede?
I know. If I'm Dorne right there, I'm going, me too.
I'm done. Like, and all of a sudden, they had this beautifully scripted statement, the rule of the six kingdoms, like they were ready for it, right? And the third thing is if Bran knew he was going to be king, couldn't he have warned them that the entire King's Landing was going to get burned down ahead of time to save all that civilian catastrophe? I just thought that was really interesting. And the final thing is this. There will be more Game of Thrones spinoffs in the future. There will be, assuredly. I mean, I've never seen a series end with someone looking into the distance on a boat and not have something happen after that. It's just...
There's also rumor that it would be a prequel. Right, so all of the lead up, how did the Targaryens come to power in the first?
Here's where I think Game of Thrones really screwed up. Here's where I think Game of Thrones really missed the boat. Is that, and this is where Breaking Bad Going back to Breaking Bad.
I was going to say, are you evading the question,
no,
sir?
No, Breaking Bad was better, and I'm going to tell you why. Breaking Bad did time transfers better than any other television series. Now, Breaking Bad was amazing because you start with a totally innocent character, Walter White. Literally, how could you have a more innocent name than Walter White as a high school teacher with a full head of hair turn into the anti-hero? And that's been talked about by a lot of people, but it's beautiful the way they did that. It's the opposite. It's the Sopranos thing where you fall in love with the villain. That's why the Sopranos and Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones are so amazing, because you actually fall in love with the bad guy. But here's where Game of Thrones really screwed up. This final season, they could have used Bran as a centerpiece character to look backwards towards all the characters that we totally miss. Ned Stark. Like, I miss Ned Stark.
I've been missing Ned Stark.
But here's what they could have done. So before the Great Conflict, because there's so much wasted time in this season, what they could have done, they could have had a moment where Bran was sitting around the fire. I could have wrote this. And they could have all had their opportunity to touch Bran and go backwards to things that would have ended the season more accurately. So they could have went backwards when they were kids under Ned Stark and bring back Ned Stark for an episode.
It would have been the most beloved moment. Could you imagine? Of the final season had Ned Stark made a cameo.
They could have had a moment where Sansa looks back to something that Catelyn Stark told her. They could have had a moment when Jon Snow goes back when he and Ned Stark might have been hunting alone. And there would have just been this conflict of, you're not really a Stark. You see what I'm saying? That's the one thing Breaking Bad did better than any other show I've ever seen, is time transfers. They went back when Walter White was younger. They went back when Jesse was younger. They went back.
The flashbacks. Yeah, certainly.
But Game of Thrones really refused to do that in this last. I'm sure it was considered by the writers. I'm not trying to dismiss that. I'm sure this was thrown around. But I think from a fan standpoint and a connection of narrative, Game of Thrones was, it felt as if this one season was its own entity in and of itself. When in reality, this was an extension from Ned Stark's beautiful first season, one of the most amazing acting performances we've ever seen. And all of a sudden, we just disappear. We never hear from him again. You know, another character that we don't talk about a lot, Robb Stark. Robb was a great actor. Robb was the fallen from grace. And how cool would it have been, Andrew, if Jaime Lannister would have thought back to his father, would have thought back to Tywin, another great character that we just forgot about. Or Tyrion would have went back to his struggle with his father. So I think there could have been a lot more internal character struggle going back to the last seven seasons that got us where we were there.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny being in LA and all, you know, a lot of writers' rooms will say that flashbacks are a cheap device or something like that. But I actually think
I think you're absolutely right.
I mean, Sean Bean, the actor who played Ned Stark, I mean, it was absolutely beloved
I don't think it's a cheap device at all. I think it's highly effective. And if it's a cheap device, why is Godfather 2 considered one of the greatest movies
100%.
Of all time? Godfather 2, the entire thing's a flashback.
Well, listen, I mean, I think this whole story of Game of Thrones world is created upon these very intricate storylines that require...
That all of a sudden we forget
about
you
them. Understand, you need to understand the history of the world.
And the last thing is this, is that if the way... If we were to take their storyline as it was, the way I would have ended the season is have one moment of Bran, Jon Snow, Sansa, and Arya together huddling, at least vocalizing and reflecting on Ned Stark, Catelyn Stark, Robb Stark, Theon, all the people we've lost, and having that last moment to summarize all the time we've spent on these characters. And I only got into Game of Thrones because of Ned Stark. Ned Stark, because he was a character, Boromir in Lord of the Rings, is why I started watching Game of Thrones. Anyway, so long answer, Breaking Bad is actually better, I think, because they finished the character development in a much more, I think, accurate and more completion.
Well, actually,
they're both amazing.
I wish that they would have ended Game of Thrones just on Jon Snow killing Dany. I think that would have actually been a cleaner ending. Didn't need to see all the... When Jon Snow killing Dany, I wish that's the way it would have ended, with Daenerys dying in his arms. It was a good goodbye.
I didn't like that at all. It felt too... Everything about Game of Thrones was always about disruption and not about that Hollywood cinematic. There's nothing about the Red Wedding that was Hollywood cinematic, right? The Red Wedding was brutal and it was abrupt and it came out of nowhere.
I didn't need how clean it ended. They didn't need
to
tie it up in a bow.
It felt way too exactly. It was different than the rest of the beautiful season. So the beautiful journey. So
series, yeah.
So anyway, I could go on for a while with Game of Thrones. We might do a whole nother episode dissecting it, because there's so many things. So if you had to actually go through the really big themes of Game of Thrones, one is, what does loyalty actually mean? The other is your word actually good for? How many times in your series did you hear, well, you have my word. My word is my honor. And that was violated many times. And kind of the oath of your word and the weight of your word is another big thing. And the final thing is, what does it actually mean to be a member of a family? That's the other big part of it. Because is Theon a Stark? Is Jon Snow a Stark? So on and so forth. With that being said, this has been fun. Please give us 5 stars. Subscribe. Charlie Kirk signing off from The Charlie Kirk Show. We'll be back next week.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest.